Please join me in welcoming Mukhtar Ibrahim, founder of Sahan Drone.
Thank you.
Mukhtar, you are not from the United States. You immigrated here in 2005. Where were you born, and what was your path to Minnesota?
First of all, thank you so much for all being here. It's early in the morning, a little bit colder than Minnesota. My brother, who came here before us in 1999, sponsored us to come to the United States. And we came here in 2005. In October, it was a little bit cold than, you know, well, in East Africa. It was fall, the trees were all, you know, the leaves were falling down, and it was quite, you know, fascinating thing to see the change in weather, because in where I came from, the weather is almost always the same. It's very cold, and you don't normally see trees, you know, losing their leaves. So it was quite an experience, and we went through the public school system in St. Paul, and went to the University of Minnesota to get my degree in journalism, and then went on to get my master's from Columbia University.
So, can we go back a little bit?
Sure.
So your brother came over in 1999. What brought him to the United States?
So my brother left Somalia when it was peaceful. He left in 1989. When everything was normal before the civil war broke out in 1991. So he went to Sudan to get his education, and he got his bachelor's from a university in Sudan, and then he went on to Malaysia to get his master's. And as he was finishing up, the country was caught up in civil war, and he could not go back to Somalia, so he sought asylum in the United States. And that's why he came to the United States in 1999, and that's after a couple of years when he became a citizen, he sponsored us to join him in St. Paul.
And your journey went from Somalia to Ethiopia, and then you moved to Kenya, and there was a delay in making the trip to the United States.
Yeah, so my brother sent us a sponsorship in 2002. Just 2 years after 9/11, and that delayed the process of us coming here. So we have to wait for like almost 4 years to get through the process of resettlement, and things were complicated by, you know, what happened in September 11, and that delayed our process, and we stayed in Kenya for that period to kind of wait for us to get processed and come here in St. Paul.
And your brothers, you're one of six.
Well, yes, I have five siblings.
Five siblings. And your brother that sponsored you now is still in Minnesota?
Yeah, he is in St. Paul. He's an educator. So when he sponsored us, he was working for St. Paul Public Schools. And now he runs a charter school in St. Paul that serves predominantly Somali kids from K to 12.
And you shared that we moved here and finished at the U, and that you with a journalism degree, but that wasn't the path that you were on originally, right? You were on this study medicine.
Yeah, so I started off as a pre-med, so I took a lot of science courses with the expectation that I will make my parents happy and become a doctor. you know, immigrant parents have that expectation of, you know, their kids will go to engineering or being a doctor with the, you know, secure professions that they can easily relate to. So I took a lot of science courses with my younger brother, who was into science as well. And I studied the MCAT, the medical college admissions test that is required before you enroll in medical school. And as I was doing that, I wasn't feeling science. Like I didn't have that passion of sitting in a classroom or a laboratory, or like spending a lot of time, you know, figuring out, you know, the details of what you know, the experiment says. Though I was good in science and I, you know, was getting good grades, I wasn't feeling it. And as I was taking science courses, I was also involved in, you know, a lot of English classes, literature, creative writing, and I felt more connected to, like, you know, the writing aspect of what in my you know, graduate, in my undergrad. So I was very passionate to, you know, write a paper and I felt more happy when, you know, I submit a paper, and that I thought that was where I will be. And in my junior year, I declared journalism as a major and abandoned biochemistry with this, you know. My parents are not quite happy, and I have to explain what, you know, that process and what journalism is, and how can, you know, I support myself and potentially when I get the family, my family.
And so they believed you, and you went on to Columbia for graduate school of journalism, and your brother, another brother, became a doctor.
Yeah, the younger brother ended up becoming a doctor, and now he's doing his residency in Springfield, Illinois. So he has one more year left, and I'm glad we have at least one doctor in the house now. Yeah.
So interesting. You just mentioned that one of the things, expectation of immigrant families or parents, that it's the medical field, and what else did you
say? Like engineering, being a lawyer, the, you know, things that.
Why is that?
You know, I think it depends on. Having a secure life, you came here with the expectation that, you know, you will have a better life than the lives of your parents. So those professions are, you know, like the ones that they can easily relate to in terms of like career wise and security wise, financial aspect of it, and they can easily relate to what a doctor is. You know, doctor treats people, and it's something that they have seen when even they were back home. But they can't relate to like being a journalist, someone with a pen and a notebook trying to make a career out of it. It's something a little bit complicated than being an engineer or a doctor.
So we're going to get back to that, but really importantly, how was the first winter and first snowfall in Minnesota? What was that?
Oh, I don't even remember. I've been in Minnesota for like 13 years, and it just... but yeah, it was, you know, unusually cold, but we had the opportunity because my brother was here before us, and we felt, you know, we had, were prepared, and he told us you have to put on layers of clothes so that you won't get very cold. And but you know, it is something, you know, very unusual. It's really cold, and you have to get used to it, and forget that it's cold, because, but yeah, I think the fact that my brother was here before us really helped us in terms of getting prepared and getting accumulated with the weather quickly. And, you know, you have to wear boots and, you know, mittens and like thick jackets so that you don't feel the cold. So it was really cold. But you know, seeing the snowflakes falling down from the sky was really, you know, beautiful and amazing.
And is it really true that your parents will winter in East Africa next winter?
Oh yeah, they don't want to stay another winter in Minnesota. The one we had was really very bad, and they said they can't have another winter in Minnesota, so they are planning to go back later in the fall, probably November, before we had the first winter storm.
Can we talk a little bit about journalism?
Sure.
And
that's what they know the best.
So let's just start with, how do you think of reporting and journalism versus storytelling? And maybe a little background. You graduated with a journalism degree. You worked for Minnesota Public Radio, mm-hmm. Star Tribune, and a number of other outlets.
Right.
And then you've been recognized on a number of fronts by your peers.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk more about that. You received the Bush Fellowship and went to Columbia for graduate school in New York in journalism.
Right.
Will you talk a little bit about reporting and journalism versus storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, reporting is something that is really essential in our lives. When you go out and you interview someone and you put together that as a story, and you fact check all the facts that the person told you, and you are essentially like, you are there to inform the public and tell them what's going on in the neighborhoods, in the schools, in local government. And it's essential to, you know, a democratic society to have that tool of people getting informed, because that's what separates, you know, people. If you are not well informed, you're not going to make quick, you know, decisions about who to vote for and where your money is going, your taxpayers' money is going, and all that. So that's what journalism is. And journalism is also storytelling, and you can do both. Like, but the storytelling, anyone can do that if you are a writer, and or you know, if you're passionate about writing, you can tell your own stories in first person, or you know, Twitter threads nowadays. You can go to Twitter and write your own story. But what separates that from journalism is, you know, you have to follow some certain principles, because we are recording history in the moment, and you know, people will go back and read that in the archives and know what happened at that certain period.
You talked about when you were writing at the U, you were talking, you felt, you had a feeling about what you were doing versus the medical career, the medical courses, science courses. Will you talk about that feeling about when it comes to writing and telling stories of others? What is that feeling?
It's a good feeling, like the person is trusting you with your story, and you know, when you meet when you meet someone for the first time, they are strangers to you, but like you're going into their houses and eating their food and talking to them, and that person becomes somehow like a friend to you. And for someone to trust you with your story is a big responsibility, and you have to do a justice to that person so that you can tell their story in a more fair, accurate, and balanced way. So, you know, I think having that license of like talking to someone and interviewing anyone, whether that means a president or, you know, someone standing on the street, is really powerful. And I felt, you know, you can't have any other profession that you can do that, you know? And having that story being published and read, everyone is, and getting calls and emails, it's really empowering.
Are there stories that come to mind that stand out for you when you reflect on the last few years that you'd be willing to share?
Ooh, I have done a lot of stories. I don't know where to start. I think the one that often comes to mind is I did a profile of a 12-year-old Somali kid in Minnesota who responded to Ben Carson during the election in 2016, the campaign, when Ben Carson said a Muslim person cannot be a president. So that person was just sitting, you know, in the living room of his house with his parents, and he heard that, you know, Ben Carson saying that. And that kid asked, you know, his mother to, you know, grab her iPhone and record him, and he wanted to respond to Ben Carson. And he recorded a video and posted on his mother's Facebook page. And I came across of that video, and I felt like that was really unique. A 12-year-old kid paying attention to what's going on in the country was really interesting to me. So I pitched the idea to my editor and told him that I think this is a very interesting story. We should do a profile of the kid. And I ended up going to his house and interviewing his parents and his teachers and the 12-year-old kid. And I wrote the profile of him. And that story really just went crazy. It went viral. Everyone picked up. All the national outlets really ended up interviewing him and coming to St. Paul, the BBC, CNN. Like, you know, he became a local celebrity, basically, and people now call him the future president when they meet him. he told Ben Carson that he will be the first Muslim president, and he will prove him wrong. And I thought that was really interesting, and it showed, you know, what was going on in the country at that moment, that everyone was really paying attention, and a lot of people, especially from immigrant backgrounds and Muslims, were, you know, they were not, you know, uncomfortable with what was going on and what was being said in the campaign trail at the time.
When you think of immigration in our country, what are the factors that you think of? As you mentioned, that this 12-year-old can dream that he will be one day the president of the United States. What do you see in the immigrant community, in the Somali community, that you think we should know? I mean, this is the kernel of mm-hmm. Sahan Journal, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
That there are stories that you recognize are not being shared accurately about the immigrant community, the refugee communities. Can you talk to us about some of those stories that you're aware of that mm-hmm. you believe people should hear about, should learn about?
Yeah, I go back often to 2016 when we were, you know, hearing all this rhetoric around immigrants and Muslims and refugees, and the local media at the time was just reporting on what these politicians were saying. And I felt these communities were really ignored in terms of like telling stories from their own perspectives and sharing, you know, their life experiences, how this rhetoric affects their lives, what will end up happening if, you know, Trump gets elected, and how his policies will shape their lives and all that. So those kind of stories that, you know, affect people's lives were not really portrayed in the local media, and I was a little bit, I wasn't surprised, but I was shocked that, you know, we are not really hearing from the communities that will be really impacted by what was going on at the time and what will end up happening right now.
What do you think is most misunderstood from the Somali community to when you think of the state of Minnesota? And maybe before that, let's talk about the journal, the platform mm-hmm. that you're creating. Will you define it for us and talk a little bit about where that has come from?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the journal is called Sahan Journal. Sahan is a Somali word meaning it's a pioneer. So we are trying to pioneer a new way of storytelling around immigrants and refugees in Minnesota. And the project came out of my experience working at, you know, some of the largest newsrooms in Minnesota. And some of them is what I mentioned, you know, in 2016, and how we go about telling the stories of these growing immigrant communities in Minnesota. And I felt, you know, these communities were really undercovered, and their stories are not told in a way that's authentic and meaningful. And I am just trying to fill that gap and void that currently exists. And the idea is to really tell these stories in a more accurate, nuanced, and comprehensive way, so that we can, you know, educate the larger community about these growing immigrant communities in our midst.
Do you see that happening in other communities? Have you seen that? Anything similar in the country?
There are quite a few small projects in other places. One of them is called Undocumented. They cover undocumented immigrants in New York City, but I haven't seen a publication that's just trying to cover all immigrant communities in one place.
So, as a journalist, you obviously have a lot of peers. When you think of other reporters, other journalists, will you talk a little bit about the importance of diversity as mm-hmm. a journalist and what that means to the stories, to what gets reported? And diversity in race, gender, mm-hmm. religious belief?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, journalism is the least diverse professions. I think now, when I look back at the newsrooms that I worked, they were predominantly white. There wasn't any people who have accents or who are wearing the hijab or anything like that. And, you know, that really affects how we tell these stories of other people. If you don't have a newsroom that's not reflective of the audience that it's serving, it's doing a really disservice to that community, and it's not really portraying all these stories in an equal way. You will undercover some communities, and you will... And the stories you tell of these communities are not going to be really deep, and they are not going to touch below the surface. It's going to be like a stereotypical way of covering these communities. You will just go into those communities when something happens, when a law is passed in Washington, when a crime happens in that community. And that's what, you know, you will hear most of the times, because that's what is the news at the moment. And we don't normally hear from, you know, their lives, how they are raising a family, how they're being successful, the challenges that they are facing, the struggles, and the, you know, stories that we need to be told, you are not going to hear that, and the only thing that you will take away from those communities are, you know, the superficial type of coverage that you normally see when you don't have a very diverse newsroom, because that will really affect how these communities are being portrayed in the media.
Because there's just not a knowledge of it.
It's just a knowledge or people from those communities that can tell their own stories, or newsrooms might not, that those communities are not their audience, and probably they are not the ones who are reading the coverage because they're not being served. So what sells, you know, the newspaper in the morning, who gets, you know, the newspaper in front of their door will be the main audience that will be targeted to that story.
So when you think of more comprehensive news coverage, it seems that in some instances there can be backlash and it's not accepted by all. Or can you talk a little bit about that? How do you handle that? Or what do you see in the future regarding that?
Yeah, and in my approach, I hope to engage, you know, all the immigrant communities that I'm trying to serve. And we want to re-engineer the way we do journalism right now. We want to be highly community-centered, where we involve the community in our reporting. We will have listening sessions. We will ask the people what are some of the areas that are interest to them, what are the problems that currently exist, and how we are going to address and solve those issues. And instead of just going and being like only one-way direction, where the reporter comes to these communities and that person gets out, we want to be with the community. We want to stay with them and tell their stories. And we want the community to shape that, you know, what we are going to write and cover. And they're going to be part of the process instead of away from the process.
One of the things I think is really impressive with this is something you showed yesterday, is when you think of, if I understood correctly, in Somalia and Ethiopia and in Kenya, the idea of journalism is not what we have in the United States, freedom of the press.
Right.
And that this has come from, that you also have that reality and that background and understanding from you and from your family.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the places that they grew up, I mean, the media usually tells narratives. It's mainly controlled by the government, and when you have something that's controlled by the government, you won't have the accuracy and the diversity of stories. It's being shaped by what the government wants at that time, the policies, and what's going to make them look good. So having, you know, coming here and having that freedom of the press, and though now we are being called the enemy of the people, and it's a little bit complicated right now in 2019, but having that press freedom and kind of, you know, that independence and telling the stories and holding officials accountable, it's something that's really powerful and empowering, and it's, you know, I'm glad we have that kind of opportunity to tell everything that we are comfortable with.
Can we talk a little bit about what you just mentioned, and this isn't politics, but more about the idea that we're in a 24-hour news cycle? And that it seems as though a lot of the news that we get is more commentary and people sitting around our table.
Yeah.
a lot of people sitting around tables talking about what their opinions are.
Right.
Will you talk a little bit about that as you looked at that in your studies and your work?
Yeah, I mean, we are really in a very polarized, you know, environment right now, and people are choosing what is news for them. They have a lot of options to kind of consume what they want. If you want to watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, you can easily do that. And you know, we are seeing a lot of newspapers closing down across the country and shutting down, especially local newspapers. And that really affects, you know, the democratic process. People are not going to get informed. But, you know, yeah, you're right. It's a lot of commentary, a lot of Facebook and Twitter stuff that you might not think it's news, but, you know, people are consuming that, and they are, you know, thinking that it's coming from a respected, trusted source, though it might be otherwise. And I think, you know, people have to be consumers of news in a way that's critical. They have to really criticize what they are seeing and what they are coming across. Is this really a trusted news? Is this really news? Is this a commentary? And if we have, you know, people who are educated in how to at least critique the news, I think we'll have a healthy democracy. But nowadays, it's like you are seeing all these feeds coming at you, and it's hard to distinguish what's trusted and what's not.
Mm-hmm. You still have to be a critical thinker.
So right. Absolutely.
Accept.
Highly critical.
Your Twitter handle was recognized as being the best Twitter account in Minnesota by the Society of Professional Journalists.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Would you talk about what you've been doing on Twitter that resulted in this recognition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I created my Twitter account when I was sitting in a journalism class in 2009, I think. And I just felt that, you know, it was an open platform where anyone can follow you and really see what you are tweeting. And I felt that, you know, I should... my initial thought was like I need to kind of write whatever I want without a permission from my editor. You know, it's a platform. You are basically it's your own newspaper. You are building your own platform and you are telling your own stories and sharing your own links and what's happening in the community. So that I when I created, I never really went back. I stayed with Twitter and it's my favorite platform at the moment. I don't use other feeds, but. I love Twitter, and it's a way for me to kind of tell my own story, tweet my own stories, and share, you know, my experiences with my followers. And it's really a good platform that is easily accessible and highly useful for journalists because, you know, it's if you build an audience, you have that audience, and you're serving an audience, and that's what journalism is, serving and informing and telling people what's going on.
Twitter in particular is or can be a dialogue with people
mm-hmm.
as they respond.
Right.
Are there common questions that you're responding to that people send when you post?
Yeah, I tend to kind of, because anyone can respond to you and you can't respond to anyone. So I try to minimize my interactions with, you know, people because I don't want to get into Twitter spots and all that. I try to avoid, you know, getting into conflicts on Twitter. So I just try to, you know, tweet and inform my audience about, you know, journalism, what I'm interested in, foreign affairs, politics, sometimes Vikings, and what's going on. So
you were born in Somalia, you grew up in Kenya and Ethiopia, you moved to Minnesota. You've been in Minnesota your entire adult life, longer than any other place. What do you wish people would know about your immigration story?
Oof. I mean, my immigration story is one that is really straightforward process. It's complicated. You have for someone to come here, it's really a long process. Like they, you have to go through. An in-depth medical test. You have to give up all your information and contacts and your names and anyone you're related to. So it's not just like an easy process.
Can you do that again? You have to go through a medical exam?
You have to go through a medical exam. You have to like, they will do a background check on you. You will give up all your names and anyone that you know. And it's, you know, it's a tedious process. And it's really complicated, and people think, you know, immigrants come here in a very easy way. So that's what we went up. That's what it took us like almost 4 years, because when 9/11 happened, everything was changed. And for someone to come here, it's really complicated process. And you come here and try to build your own life. You know, you are building things from scratch. You left your own country, and you basically don't have anything. And you're just trying to survive and build, you know, a career and raise a family, and it's very challenging, and it's something that very personal that I usually don't like talking about because I sometimes get emotional about it.
Thanks for sharing. So a couple of facts that I think struck me in preparation for this conversation was 80% of startups in the last 3 years were created by immigrants or first generation residents, citizens. And 47% of doctors in South Dakota are immigrants. So you usually ask the questions when you interview someone. So how am I doing?
Oh, you're doing a good job.
I really appreciate that. How is it answering questions? You just talked a little bit about answering questions about immigration, but how is it when you're answering questions instead of asking them?
Yeah, I'm the one who is asking questions and shaping the conversation, but it's interesting to be on the reverse side. And I think you're doing a good job of, like, you know, you're prepared and asking good questions, so that really helps.
Thanks. You're a family, including three children. You have three children and your wife in Minnesota. What kind of other questions do you guys have that your children ask you about East Africa, about here?
Yeah, I have three daughters. The oldest is, she'll be 5 in 2 weeks. She goes to preschool, and she'll be graduating for preschool in May 24th. So we are definitely looking forward to that. But she's really very curious about the school, and she asks, you know, questions about Christmas, Halloween, and things, you know. As a Muslim person, we don't celebrate, and for her to kind of be that curious and, you know, at that early stage, and, you know, we have to explain about, you know, the holidays and the events and all that, it's, you know, what most immigrants go through. You have to balance, you know, two worlds, and but she is really interested in school, in learning, and she's just 5 years old, so what she can ask is very limited, but the questions that she asks are, you know, essential to the process of being an immigrant and trying to, you know, tell your, you know, kids about life and what we went through, and without, you know, being too complicated, you have to simplify the process and explain them in a way that they can easily relate to. So as they grow older, we expect, you know, more complicated questions. So she's 5 and she's amazing. And the 4-year-old is just, she will start preschool soon, but she's also as curious as her sister.
And then they have a 10-month-old.
We have 10 months old, yes.
So if we talk about the journalism and the way that you describe it, it reminds me, instead of a profession or a career, it's much more of a vocation. Mm-hmm. Will you talk a little bit more about that, and is it a career, or it just seems like it's much more of something that is who you are and how you want to live?
Yeah, I think journalism for me is both a career and a passion, and I don't see myself doing anything else. I came across to becoming a doctor this close, having, you know, telling a story about people, it's what any human being can relate to. It's what I think unites us as human beings. We all crave for stories and learning from other people and hearing their stories. So being the one who tells that is I think, a big responsibility. And we journalists really go above and beyond to be fair to our, you know, sources and the subjects that we are writing about, so that we are going to portray them in the most accurate way of what they told us at that moment.
And along the way, have you had a mentor or somebody that's had an enormous impact that you'd be willing to talk
about? Yeah, when I was in journalism school, there was a reporter that I really admired. Her name is Laura Ewan. She was covering the, you know, immigrant communities and refugees in Minnesota at the time. And I felt she was one of the few individuals who are trying to really establish connections and trust in these communities. she was, you know, having coffee with people, going to mosques, and trying to really learn. She was really interested in learning from these communities. And the journalism school has a mentorship program where you fill out a form and you put, you know, anyone that you think could be your mentor. And she was the only one that I put down. And she ended up being my mentor. And after a couple of years, she became my colleague and friend. And she now sits on the board of Sahan Journal.
And one of the things that, with, if I understand correctly, of Sahan Journal is that you want to mentor other reporters, that you want to create a team of people that ultimately mentor others and their communities. We talked a little bit about why that, you think that's important.
Yeah, I think looking back at my, you know, career and when I was in undergrad, when you are trying to figure out journalism and you don't know anyone who looks like you doing this job, it becomes difficult and you feel like isolated and not supported. So I'm just trying to kind of duplicate that process of the opportunity that I got in my undergrad. And I want to really mentor and inspire young students from immigrant backgrounds to tell their own stories, to shape their own narratives. And we're targeting, like, you know, freshmen and people in college. We want to give them a chance to kind of, you know, tell their own stories and mentor them and, you know, inspire for them to take at least, you know, one writing class or one journalism class, so that if they want to be reporters, they will have a platform that, you know, will publish their stories and guide them along the way. And then when they graduate from college, they will have a solid portfolio that, you know, they can take it to anywhere else, Star Tribune, Pioneer Press, or other places that do journalism. So it's just a platform that, you know, just trying to inspire more people from immigrant background to be reporters.
When you think of the advice that you've been given over your career life, is there something that stands out that is the best piece of advice that you reflect on?
Yeah, I think the best one is to never give up. I was told that I will hit roadblocks and people will try to bring you down, and you know, you will have some people who will critique your work, and but I was told not to give up, and I think that was the best advice for me to practice. And as you know, as I was spinning my career, I faced a lot of roadblocks, but I never gave up in, you know, this profession. I think it's one that's really powerful, and for me to have that power is really important to me.
And when you think of the advice that you've given to people?
Never give up. Just passing on that advice to other people.
Will you talk about defining a community? How do you define a community?
Oh, well, that's a very hard question. I think we are all community. I think this is a community. People from diverse backgrounds coming together, having a conversation is, I think, a community. And it's the most essential way of learning from each other, understanding our perspectives, our backgrounds. And I think if we just talk to each other, I think we'll find more commonalities than people expect. Even if you hate someone, but you have, you know, a conversation with that someone, you will get closer, you will have some respect to that person's perspective, and you will get to know that person, and probably they will end up being your friend. So I think, I feel like this is a community to me.
And when you talk a little bit about democracy, I want to just ask that really big question.
Yeah.
Democracy, and your take on that. How do you define it, and what are the important pieces of that in the United States specifically?
Yeah. I think democracy is what makes a place to have a peaceful coexistence without. We want to respect people's diverse opinions. If, you know, you have a certain political ideology, then your mother or your neighbor, I think that's okay. And I think, as you know, we respect each other because of who we are and because of what we practice, and having that coexistence while we have those diverse opinions is what, you know, makes democracy work. And participating in an election and shaping, you know, giving your voice to the person that most aligns with your values, and not getting upset if someone gets elected or your opponent, you know, gets the win is, I think, what I will define as a democracy.
When you look ahead with in journalism, what do you imagine will be the most significant change in the next 10 years?
I hope cities to have more local press. I hope local, you know, people who have some wealth will try to save journalism by investing in local journalism. Because if we lose that, I think the thing we just talked about, democracy won't work, and people will be in the dark about, you know, what's going on. So I hope in the next 10 years we'll see more local newspapers popping up in small places, and I hope to see more abundance of, you know, local press. And I think that's what the danger is, toward, you know, losing that kind of local coverage about, you know, obituaries and local elections and you know, schools and the test scores and all that. If we don't cover those small, you know, small coverage, small, you know, news that are happening in neighborhoods, I think we will have a hard time as a society in terms of, like, you know, getting informed and knowing what's going on.
So when you look at the landscape today, and we've had a lot of consolidation and mm-hmm. a lot of reductions in news coverage, you've talked a little bit about, yesterday, the number of independent publications mm-hmm. and how that's changing with nonprofits like the one that you're creating.
Right.
Can you give us a little bit more context on that? How many independent newspapers are there?
In
news coverage
in Minnesota, or
sure, let's go there.
Yeah, let's start there. I think Minnesota is somehow unique than other places. Our media, you know, scene is very healthy. We have two regional newspapers in the Twin Cities, the Pioneer Press and the Star Tribune. We have a couple of radio stations and TV channels and a couple of magazines. And we have one nonprofit news organization called MIMPOST, and I'm starting a new nonprofit organization that will add something to the current media landscape. We have other small papers covering neighborhoods in Minneapolis and in the Twin Cities in general. So I think we are in a good shape, and I hope to see similar things in other cities across the country.
And you mentioned too that Minnesota has the highest turnout.
Voter turnout.
And we talked a little bit why you think that's the case.
Yeah, I think people are just interested in participating in the process, and I think with the health media scene and newspapers covering, you know, all issues across the state, I think might have something to, you know, add to that in terms of, like, informing people about, you know, what's coming up, what's going on in their local municipalities and what's going on. So, yeah, Minnesota has been like that for, you know, many years, and it's the state that has the largest voter turnout in the country, and people are really engaged in the process, and I feel like, you know, immigrants will also play a role in that process of making sure they have local representatives. We have the most diverse state legislatures in the history of Minnesota. We got people voted, you know, a couple of politicians from the Hmong community. We have several legislatures from the Somali background, and it's the first time we are seeing this much diversity in the state legislature in the history of Minnesota.
So can we take a step back and understand a little bit of how Minnesota has been this state that's seeing this population growth
mm-hmm.
and this strong, growing, robust economy. Mm-hmm. And one of the, with the Twin Cities, it's one of the best places to move. More people are moving there than many, many mm-hmm. cities across the country. It's also the home of a number of immigrant communities. We talk a little bit about how Minnesota has grown to be this mm-hmm. and this economic engine and this
mm-hmm.
state
yeah.
that you were just describing.
Yeah, I mean, Minnesota has always been a welcoming state to immigrants and refugees, and as more people from immigrant backgrounds came in, they established their lives in Minnesota, and now they are growing and they are participating in the democratic process. And we are seeing a huge increase in, as we are seeing a decline in the, you know, the white population, we are seeing a much growing population from the immigrant background. So the statistics shows that as, you know, Minnesota gets older, immigrants will play a key role in that population growth. And I was looking at the data the other day, and it showed that the population growth in 2018 was due to two reasons: people coming from other states and immigrants. Today, one in six kids born in Minnesota is a child of an immigrant. And the data really shows that these are really growing immigrant communities, and it's making, you know, the state march rich in cultural diversity, and people are working, you know, at 3M and these big companies, and they're just contributing to the society as anyone else.
What's the, when you mentioned their work, people are working, what's the unemployment rate in Minnesota?
For now, I think it's around 3%, if I'm not wrong. It's very low.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about more context of your background?
Mm-hmm, sure.
So one of the things that I was, that was great for to learn personally, was how young officially Somalia is as a country.
Mm-hmm.
Will you give us a little background on the formation of the country and the place where it is in the world and a little bit of the history?
Yeah. Yeah, so Somalia is located in the Horn of Africa, under the East Africa. If you look at the map, it's just at the corner, you know, next to Ethiopia and Kenya and Djibouti. So it was formed in 1960 after the unification of two entities. The southern part was colonized by Italy, and the other northern part was colonized by Britain. So in 1960, the two groups came together and formed what is now called the Somali Republic. So after a couple of years in, I think, 1965, Somalia had the first election. And the first, you know, it's the first democratic process in Africa where the handover happened very peacefully in a very democratic process. And then in 1969, it was a military dictator came over and took over the leadership of the country, and that person ruled Somalia for almost two decades. And in 1991, the central government collapsed, and there was a civil war that we are seeing its consequences going on up to now.
I'm thinking of a conversation that we had with the then Governor Dennis Dugard, and he's second generation U.S. born, I think I got that right. You have three children. Can you imagine one of your children's children being the governor of Minnesota?
I hope so. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but hopefully, you know, I hope to give them all the courage and the chances that they want, and I want to raise my kids as, you know, in other parent. I want them to be engaged citizens. I want them to be successful, and it will be up to them to kind of be who they are in the future. If they want to be a politician or a journalist or a doctor, they will have that, you know, opportunity.
Is this the experience that you thought it was going to be when you came over and as a teenager?
No, not really. I had no idea what life will be after I came here when I was 17, and I really didn't know what, you know, life will be after, you know, after 14 years. So, but now I'm committed. I know where, you know, I'm going, and I will stick with journalism, and we'll see how where that, you know, takes me in the future.
What do you want me to know about immigration in the United States?
Well, that's immigration is really complicated because we are all immigrants to this country, right? But nowadays we see immigrants being vilified and being portrayed as, you know, they are the bad people, and that's, you know, what most probably Americans who don't know anything about, you know, immigration, immigrants will, you know, get away with when they hear politicians saying negative things about immigrants. But you know, immigrants are, you know, playing a key role in our lives. We are just trying to live a life like any other person. And, you know, we are entrepreneurs, as you mentioned in the data. We are, you know, forming our own organizations, our own companies, and we're just trying to contribute as much as possible to the, you know, our neighbors, and we want to get to know them, and we want to have, you know, a better life for our kids and anyone that, you know, we know. So I think, you know, just, you know, if you see someone that's different from you, someone that has a different name, a different accent, just get to know them and see, you know, ask them, you know, questions about their life, and I think they will tell you more inspiring things that you will normally hear from, you know, TV stations or from politicians.
Mukhtar, you have been very, very kind in this conversation and prepping for this. We talk a lot about your personal journey, and I know that's personal, and can be difficult. And I really appreciate your willingness to be able to share. The question about earlier, what do you wish people would know about your immigration story? Obviously, the immigration story is a part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's not who you are.
Right.
Right. And I just really appreciate that you went down, that you're willing to share. What would you say to the question of what should people know about you and take away the immigration story? What would you want people to leave here with?
Mm-hmm.
About who you are?
Yeah, I am a father, a husband, a journalist, someone who is just trying to, you know, do my best. I wanna, you know, present the, you know, best version of me as much as possible. And I think that is a summary of who an immigrant is someone who's, you know, working very hard to have a better life in this country and kind of contribute to, you know, the society and where they live. And, you know, I hope, you know, people will open up their eyes and get to know someone that looks different from them and speaks different from them, eats different from them. And if we continue doing that, I think we'll have a very vibrant and healthy society.
Thank you for being with us this morning. Thanks for coming from the Twin Cities over here and visiting yesterday and today. I know it's a lot to do. We really appreciate what you've shared.
Thank you for inviting me to the Durham Embassy. I appreciate it.